This podcast and the following message are made possible by Trunk Club, a clothing service that's changing the way men shop. Between the weddings, the barbecues, and the heat, dressing for the summer poses its challenges. With Trunk Club, your personal stylist will find the best clothes to keep you cool and stylish at trunkclub.com/NPR.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is so special about Dallas's Deep Ellum neighborhood, and what can its evolution demonstrate about creating walkable, livable urban spaces? The area that came to be known as Deep Ellum was not master planned. It has grown and changed incrementally over more than a century, from an industrial center to a nationally recognized destination for African-American jazz and blues artists and their fans, to a late 20th century retail and entertainment district, and increasingly now a residential neighborhood as well. Throughout its history, Deep Ellum has benefited from its human scale and vibrant urban sensibility, qualities its 21st century champions continue to nurture and promote. Brandon Castillo is director of the Deep Ellum Outdoor Market and owner of Deep Ellum Postal and Grocer. Patrick Kennedy is an urban dynamics and planning expert and partner at the Space Between Design Studio. And Vicky Meek is manager of the South Dallas Cultural Center. So nice to have all of you on Think.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So one thing that people who love Deep Ellum love about it is the way that the neighborhood has continued to reinvent itself over the years. How much of that evolution has been part of a deliberate plan in the past several years, and how much is still happening organically?
Well, I feel a lot of what's happening is organic. It's hard, you know, given the nature of the neighborhood. I feel that people they feel it's an opportunistic place to do whatever they want to do. So, as far as a planned development goes over, at least in my experience, I think it's been a lot more freewheeling.
Yeah, I think the majority of its cycles, when it has renewed interest in it, have always been mostly bottom up and grassroots. The only real effort that's been top down that's I think has been positive for it has been when they've preserved a number of the buildings there, and that has actually allowed it to be sort of a rarity in the city. And that artists are always looking for ways to cluster and reuse old space because. Oftentimes, they don't have the capital for building new buildings, so they're just looking for space that may be, at the time, a little bit downtrodden or forgotten about, but they still need to cluster and agglomerate like a lot of different businesses do. And the very few places that still are like that in Dallas, you know, the old streetcar suburbs, Deep Ellum is probably the most collection of buildings that are still there, but it often still gets forgotten, as unlike Bishop Arts has, or Lower Greenville has. So when it goes through these cycles, people can still find opportunities. So it tends to regenerate itself as an artist community over and over again.
You still have the old buildings that have existed. Most of Dallas has been razed and built new upon, but Deep Ellum's not like that.
Yeah, and I guess I want to add that the whole issue of artists and what they've done for that area. When I moved here in 1980, that was a thriving artistic community. There were artists there, and it wasn't, you know, redeveloped in any way. It was the old storefronts were used as studios and live space. You had a real communal kind of atmosphere going on there with artists like Tracy Hicks and Barsamian living there and working there. And I guess I see it a little bit differently in that there was a plan at one point. It doesn't seem to have worked well. I think Deep Ellum has a way of sort of subverting plans because the idea was that they were going to clean it up and they were going to make it into something really sort of snazzy. And it worked for about, I guess, maybe 5 years. And then stuff began to backfire on them. The clubs began to be something that got out of hand. They weren't expecting that, which drove actually a number of the last artists that were living there out because, you know, they were living there and then there were all these kids down there, you know, playing there. And so it became a little less desirable, plus it got a lot more expensive. So I think that Deep Ellum is a good example of how a community reinvents itself but not necessarily with the idea in mind that it's going to survive itself.
That's a really interesting tension that you bring up, Vicky, is that, you know, sometimes we want to make a place better for the people who live there. It may be the people who live and work there who sort of get at the forefront of this. And then before long, an area becomes so hot that all the original residents and businesses are priced out of the market, real estate-wise.
Yeah, and we see that in New York all the time, where the artist community is constantly moving around to a different place. It's not actually in one place and stays there. They move in, they find that cheaper real estate, they create an artist community, and then other people want to be there too, right? They create the demand for other people to be there, and it ends up pricing them out. So they just move to another area and then fix that area up. I think the difference here is we don't have much of that historic fabric that's still clustered together, still remaining for it to move around to many other areas.
How did it happen that Deep Ellum, that a lot of the old buildings have been preserved, or maybe preserved is the wrong word, simply for a long time nobody was interested in coming in and knocking them down and building something else new? What's different about that area from other parts of the city where very little original development remains?
I'm not sure. I was always curious about the way in which Dallas raised historic buildings. Of course, you know, coming from the East Coast, none of it was historic to me because it wasn't 400 years
right,
old.
Right, exactly.
20 but, years old is historic here.
Yeah, I mean, I live in a historic house and it was built in 1919, really. But in any event, I was always curious about how they determined what got saved and what didn't. And then I realized it really wasn't so much about it being important, but it was about interest in whether or not it could be developed. Mm-hmm. And Deep Ellum's like a weird, it's in a weird location. It's not quite developable as far as the high rise and, you know, all of that kind of activity that goes on downtown now. Because when I moved here, downtown was not, you know, very much developed in terms of the way it is now. So I don't know. I think that, first of all, it's a scale that's a real workable scale for the way it is, that, you know, the low buildings not being high rises. It had a business community, even though it was sort of a cottage industry business community. So you didn't have a whole lot of movement as far as people just a lot of that real that industrial business area is still industrial. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're still thriving businesses. They're still there. So I think that has something to do with it. It's not an area that is as desirable as some of the others that were torn down because of the where it was situated and what was still there.
Well, if you look at Dallas in general, you can trace the highways and see how this place has developed over the past half century. And, you know, the tendency has been pushing north and pushing further north. So east of downtown, east of the core, it seems just has been forgotten.
Right. The infrastructure has essentially created an inertia of sprawl where greenfield development, it becomes the cheaper way to do it because we're essentially subsidizing the long trip, the car trip, mm-hmm. at the expense of the short and the walkable trip. And what happens is that makes development always goes out to the greenfield. And from 2000 to 2010, 83% of the housing starts were on greenfields. Meaning it wasn't an infill development that was already something else. And so what happens is it pushes demand outward, it dilutes demand, and so it just makes redoing a building, it makes it too cost ineffective right. for investors. Right. And so I think that gentrification has never really happened to Deep Ellum, and so the artist community keeps coming sort of back to it because it's that one place that's never really fully gentrified, it's never really changed, but it still has that same historic cluster of buildings.
And especially when you look at those smaller streets off of the main commerce and what have you, you know, those are still really cool spots, and there's still artists living in some of those spots.
And I feel those small streets, you know, Walton, Crowdis, mm-hmm. Pryor, those are what make the neighborhood walkable.
Right.
You don't have, you know, multi-lane, well, you know, Commerce and Elm notwithstanding. But, you know.
The two of the three.
It's crosswalks.
You do, I mean, but it does create a street fabric that's fun to walk around.
But what does that word walkability mean? It's such a buzzword now, and maybe a lot of people have a definition in their minds that may not be the sort of official definition that urban planners use. Can you talk about that, Patrick?
Sure. I think one jumping off point to talk about it is WalkScore, which is a website that is devoted to walkability. And what it measures, it's essentially a quantitative score about proximity of different things that you would want to get to. So in terms of how it works for a neighborhood, a walkable neighborhood is what we call a complete neighborhood, where you can get to all of your daily needs within a 20-minute walk or less, ideally. And so that's sort of the quantitative aspect to it. But then there's also the qualitative of what is the feel of the street like? Is there the buildings closer together? Is there shade? Are there trees? Is it safe to walk, or are the cars going to run you over? So there's the two quantitative and qualitative aspect to it, except we tend to undermine it for the priority of moving cars.
And when you look at the walkability of Deep Elm, things are close together. When you talk about shade and trees, not so much in a lot of areas. Mm-hmm. And it would seem that those putting those things in place does require a concerted effort and, mm-hmm. and people to come together and discuss what needs to happen. In what venues is that taking place? Are those discussions taking place? And who is really spearheading getting these things done?
The 2006 bond package, I believe, is now being enacted on Elm Street. So there is, you know, I've seen the plans and the sketchups mm-hmm. about, you know, more trees coming in, wider sidewalks, bike racks, things of that nature.
There is a public improvement district in the area that oversees a lot of that and puts the money from the businesses back into the streets and the infrastructure. I would like to see more innovative ways of thinking about sort of the parking, right? The parking generates revenue, which disappears into the city's general fund rather than going back into the neighborhood. And a lot of cities are moving in towards that sort of relocalization of the funding and the revenue that's generated in an area and keeping it in the area. And right now, that's not really the case.
Well, that's kind of true of all the parking in Dallas. You know, what I'd love to see is rethinking parking in Deep Elm, period, because if you look at Fort Worth, you know, they figured it out. After 6 o'clock, everything is free parking, you know, not before. And Deep Elm, it's like a pain. You go down there and, you know, they've got these 2-hour meters and you're trying to go out and have dinner or whatever you're trying to do. And it's not at all friendly for the customer. And I guess it's a lot of money they must get between that and towing that, you know, it just sort of undermines the whole feel of what Deep Elm is about. I mean, you know, most of the Deep Elm activity is happening after hours. And if you want that to be the case, then you got to make it easy for people to be there after hours and not a hostile environment. And so I'd love for the city to rethink how parking is done in that area, because, you know, it's a great place to go in the evening and have dinner or hang out if you're, you know, a club person or that kind of thing.
What does it take to attract to Deep Elm people who may not choose to live there but want to go hang out, who are not so sure that they want to have to, you know, walk 200 yards to their destination? And are those the people we want to draw to Deep Elm, or do they sort of change the character of the businesses and the climate there?
What I've been trying to do with the projects that I've done for, you know, the market and the food truck rally is to do projects and do events that make the neighborhood relevant in different cities in New York. I mean, I've patterned a lot of the events that I've done with things that I've been to in New York and San Francisco. So if you give people reason to come out, they will come out.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to actually think about it as a destination. I said this in a D Magazine article about Fair Park area in South Dallas. It was that trying to think of it as a destination and how do we get North Dallas people to come down to it is the wrong way to go about it. And creating convenient parking actually diminishes the quality of the place, and then nobody wants to go there anyway. So we have to actually make it an origin in a neighborhood, both speaking of South Dallas and Deep Elm, that it has to first be a neighborhood that people want to live, and then those people being there is why other people come in. And if they're coming in to park, I think they should actually have to pay. So that, again, keeps the money in the area, and that allows it to reinvest in the infrastructure in the area to improve the area.
We are talking about Deep Elm and urban lifestyles with Patrick Kennedy, urban dynamics and planning expert and partner at the Space Between Design Studio. Vicki Meek is here as well. She is manager of the South Dallas Cultural Center. And Brandon Castillo is director of the Deep Elm Outdoor Market and owner of Deep Elm Postal and Grocer. If you'd like to join this conversation, call us now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
At that time, Deep Ellum was the jam. It was just wall-to-wall people. It was the early 90s, so there were definitely too many Birkenstocks and things like that rolling around. But overall, it was a great place. Tons of street traffic. It was really, I thought, a rare place, a rare gem. You know, I mean, it was like a Haight-Ashbury for Dallas or something, you know.
What about that is still around in Deep Ellum?
We're around. That's about it. If this place was vacant and there was tumbleweeds rolling through downtown, we'd be perfectly stoked if it was like that, because we're not depending on our environment. We just depend on our reputation as far as the tattoo shop's concerned. I mean, things evolve. I don't necessarily expect it to stay the same. I mean, of course, I just don't want it to get too corporate.
That was Dean Williams of Elm Street Tattoo talking to Think assistant producer Lindsay Connect. Such an interesting little bit of sound there. What do we do to get people like Dean Williams to feel like he could only exist in Deep Ellum, that his business is really dependent on its location within the neighborhood as opposed to the quality of service it provides having to stand alone?
I don't know. Do we want him to feel that way? I think it's kind of cool that he's been there forever and doesn't feel like he has to leave based on what else is around him. I'm one of those people that thinks that, you know, when things come into a community, they thrive because the community wants them. And if the community doesn't want them, then they go away and other things come up that they do want. So, you know, I'm much more organic about what I would want to see happen in Deep Ellum as far as the kinds of businesses and the kinds of people that live there.
Provided the neighborhood has enough control to sort of dictate that. It's always an interesting question because you were starting to talk about issues of gentrification, and one person's gentrification is another person's investment. And it could become, like any area, could become a victim of its own success, where if the value is increasing in real estate and business opportunities, you start attracting more and more and more people want to be there, and investors want to be there. And, you know, that's always the challenge, is how do you maintain that balance of retaining character without displacing people or displacing what actually made the place interesting and why Deep Ellum lives sort of within people's hearts and minds.
Is some of that a sacrifice that you have to be willing to make if you care about a place and want it to thrive?
I think there are new ways of thinking about development. You know what I mean? It's like Patrick started that conversation when he said, if the neighborhood can control it. I think that we're beginning to understand more and more the ways in which neighborhood organizations need to function in order to keep their neighborhoods what they want them to be. I mean, I live in Old East Dallas, and we've had to have constant battles oftentimes to keep certain things from happening in our community. I think that's part of the problem. Of course, in some of the areas, like in Deep Ellum, the populations are new populations for the most part. You know, they're building these condos, et cetera. And they're not necessarily communities in the sense of the way we think of community. And that's what maybe has to happen, is that we have to start thinking about ways to create community organizations that are really community organizations, organizing the people in that community to be proactive about what they want for their communities.
Mm-hmm. And to stay engaged, yes, without preserving the place in amber. I mean, that's
right,
sort of a generic
right
idea for any neighborhood.
Right.
But you never want to just say, well, let's keep it exactly as it is, because then you'll turn away any kind of investment, so it won't improve. And that's not to say that Deep Ellum is perfect, because obviously it's imperfect too, and it needs other things and an increased investment in and around the area as well.
If I may plug the Deep Ellum Community Association, led by Sean Fitzgerald, the president, he's got an interesting concept for this particular community association, where he really wants to decentralize the way that decisions get made. The idea is to create a lot of different committees that are dedicated to, you know, a particular mission, just as long as those committees stick to the point on the horizon. Mm-hmm. Just as long as we have common goals and we're working towards a common vision, mm-hmm. which makes it a really exciting time to participate in the neighborhood.
I want to ask about age diversity. I've never lived in Deep Ellum. I did work down there for several years around the turn of the century. Isn't that funny to say?
Yeah, no.
It's far enough out that you can actually say that. My impression at the time, there weren't a lot of people who lived in the neighborhood, but there were some. But they tended to be quite young. And I wonder how important it is to think about retaining people when they get to the point in their lives when they decide to start a family and what the neighborhood needs to have in it to become a place where you can live when you're 25 and a place where you can live when you're 75 and feel welcome in both cases.
Yeah. I think there is definitely a young vibe when we think of Deep Ellum. We don't know. Although I will say that the artists who had lived there when I moved here were, I guess they were young. I'm not sure. You'd have to have a lot of amenities for a community to be totally heterogeneous, I think. Because I know that, for instance, when I first was looking at getting a place to buy, we looked at some of Bennett Miller's places, mm-hmm. and the bank wouldn't lend us the money to buy one of those condos because their thing was that they weren't seeing the turnaround. So we ended up in Old East Dallas. And I must say that I'm glad because, you know, once we started having kids, it was a good place to have the kids be. But I think that if we want to have a Deep Ellum that's totally heterogeneous, there have to be many, many more things that would accommodate that. You have to have schools. You have to have, you know, grocery stores. I mean, yeah, you can do the farmer's market somewhat, but that's a whole lot of food to buy if you only have one kid. You know, you have to have parks and things of that nature, green spaces. So, you know, I don't think it's wrong to have a place that doesn't have all that. You know, I don't think it's wrong to have a place that really just appeals to younger people, you know?
One of the beefs that I have is, Deep Ellum over, you know, however so long, being referred to as an entertainment district. And as an entertainment district, the focus is on nightlife. Whereas if you actually think of it as a real neighborhood, then, you know, you want and you're encouraged to have businesses and people out on the street during the day, which, you know, is something that I've been trying to tackle with the market and with the grocery store.
Yeah, it needs more types of housing. It needs more housing. In terms of a neighborhood, and how many people actually live in Deep Ellum, it's much smaller than what we think of as being a self-sustaining neighborhood that has enough people, about 5,000 to 7,000 people, that bring enough amenities and retail and all that different opportunities to it. And so there's that aspect, is adding the housing, and then there's the issue of walkability in terms of age diversity, because it's something that empowers everybody. You know, you don't need somebody to drive you around. You don't need mom to take you to soccer practice or whatever. I mean, it's something for kids and adults and senior citizens as well, rather than putting them in a retirement community where it's sort of golf course or golf cart bound.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Chris. Another great show.
Thank you.
And just a quick question about the definitions of where Deep Ellum is, and then a comment about Exposition Park. Do you guys consider Exposition Park and that area to be part of Deep Ellum? It's an area that's got the same kind of rich history and architectural interest, and it's really kind of cool right now with the new businesses developing down there. I'll listen off the air.
Thanks for your call.
I believe that Expo Park is included in either the Public Improvement District or the Tax Incremental Fund. But I like to think, and especially with my store, I'm definitely targeting that market to come in and shop. So they're all part of Deep Ellum as
they're
far
welcome,
as I'm concerned.
Right.
I would consider, just labeling it something else immediately springs to mind a different neighborhood, and it may have a different character. It may not over time. But just in terms of the geography, just because they blend together, you know, there's no natural border between the two of them. It still doesn't mean that it has to be part of the same neighborhood.
We never thought of Expo Park as being part of Deep Ellum when I got here. Anyway, that was Expo Park was Expo Park. By the way, another artist community.
Mm-hmm.
John Abrams and that whole group, you know, had that space and of course exposition gallery. I'm blanking on the gallery, having a senior moment here. But you know, all of those areas were artist communities. So, but we did not think of it as Deep Ellum.
Is that Central Track that's down there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, not Central Track. Is not. I'm thinking about, you know. Oh, man. Come on. The gallery. Yes. The big 500X. Gallery. There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a co-op.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk briefly before we move on to some more calls about the idea that you have, Patrick, that would keep Deep Ellum from being separated from its largest sort of neighbor, and that's downtown. Talk a little bit about what you would like to see happen with 345.
Right. 345 is the elevated highway segment between downtown and Deep Ellum. It's 40 years old on a 40-year lifespan, and about 2 or 3 years ago, we knew that this was approaching and that it had been repaired minor cracks hundreds of times. So we said, well, let's run a little thought exercise and pretend we could take it out because we knew TxDOT would be coming in eventually and saying, okay, we're either going to have to replace it, rebuild it, continue to repair it or something. And we said, you know, in other cities where they've had highways structurally fail or failing, they decide, you know what, we just don't have the money to rebuild it, so let's get rid of it. And they found that, you know, obviously it's cheaper to do that and you bring in development sites and investment. And so we said, okay, let's restitch the grid, which the highway, Central Expressway, basically tore apart. And we said, okay, let's draw a boundary around all the underdevelopment around the area, too, and see how much land we can recapture that's public right-of-way or underdeveloped, because surface parking ends up being the highest and best use along a highway all too often. And so we found doing so is that we could reposition 180 acres of land for new neighborhoods, basically what it used to be, which was about 54 city blocks of housing, of music clubs, of theaters and whatnot. And so we said, well, why not restore this? Because we've pro-formed it out and found that the city would receive about $4 billion in private investment, and which would equate to $110 million a year in property tax revenue, which right now they're only generating about three out of. So we saw it as a win-win in a number of situations because TxDOT loses a maintenance burden. Presumably the state would get the land sales and the city would get tax base.
I think anybody might look at that, listen to that, and think it sounds like a good idea, except the people who are on 345 every day, and that's their main artery to work, to school, to all the things they have to get done.
Right. And well, that's the number one question everybody always asks is what happens to the traffic. And right now there's 160,000 cars per day that run up and down it. And we actually did traffic counts on all the on and off ramps in the area too and found that only about 40,000 or a quarter of the traffic is coming to or going from or leaving from downtown Dallas. And so our stance is that a lot of this is regional traffic, a lot of it's shipping. And those logistical hubs for trucking and whatnot are not up and down 75. They're on 635 and they're on 20 and they're on 30. And so there is trucking that's going up and down there, and there's also it creates its own congestion because the highway is there, people drive there. But restitching the grid, it creates a number of opportunities. One, we ship the regional traffic around the city, right? If you're not going to the city, yeah, you shouldn't be going through the city. And then it allows us to restitch the grid and improve the several north-south connectors. And what the grid does is that it diffuses the bad congestion, right, which is cars. But it actually allows for the aggregation and agglomeration of the good congestion, which is people actually making social and economic exchange happen, which is basically walkability. And it allows businesses to cluster that want to cluster, restaurants and shopping and whatnot, too.
A suggestion that I heard in a discussion of mine with a friend about this plan specifically is that what if we imagine, you know, the fabric connected and, you know, with the walkability, with these different buildings and the businesses that are there, and then imagine bulldozing all of that and putting a highway, you know, which is a better scenario, one with a highway or one with a cohesive community?
Yeah, no city that's ever taken out a highway has ever said, oh, man, we shouldn't have done that.
Right.
Let's put it back.
Right.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Kelly in Dallas. Hey, Kelly.
Hi. My name is Kelly Clemens. I'm actually on the Deep Ellum Community Association Board, and I also lead
the Deep Ellum Urban Gardens, which is a community garden in Deep Ellum. Hello, Brandon. I just wanted to speak to something that I don't think is being talked about much, which is that there is currently a very tight-knit community already in Deep Ellum. And in referencing that the artists used to live in Deep Ellum, there are still a lot of artists that live in Deep Ellum. We have almost 30 art galleries that are currently thriving. We have a couple of thriving theaters. We have a ton of new businesses that have come in the last 2 years. And so some of the things that are being talked about that aren't happening actually are happening, and maybe people just need to come down to experience that. But I feel like we're not talking about the thriving community that's currently happening in that neighborhood. And we've recently been called the soul of Dallas, and I think that totally fits the Deep Ellum neighborhood.
Well, I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
And I apologize for making it sound as though I meant that nothing artistically was happening. Mm-hmm. I didn't. There were a lot of individual artists who lived there. It wasn't that there weren't arts organizations because, you know, Undermain, you know, of course, headquartered there for the longest. And there were other, you know, theater groups there and what have you. But there were a lot of individual artists who actually rented those storefronts.
I think the other issue is that a lot of Deep Ellum's problems are not actually in Deep Ellum. They're the immediate surrounding areas. And when we're talking about bringing in new housing, that we see that as actually the stabilizing effect to prevent all these booms and busts that it goes through. And the new population that would come in would help support those businesses and make them even more successful than they are now.
What are the best ways, or what are the ways that in Deep Ellum neighbors get to know their neighbors?
Come out to the market, guys. Every third Saturday, 11 to 5.
It's third places, right? It's places. It's not your work. It's not your home. It's people where they go out to have social and economic exchange, like a market, or Anvil Pub is obviously one of my favorites to go to. People have a beer together. I live in downtown, but I always come over to Deep Ellum just because I prefer the bars and restaurants there.
What's interesting going on across the street from my shop is this pretty much empty green field, and it's been empty since, I guess, 2008 or something like that. But, you know, I have introduced my dog to the other people there. It's become like an impromptu dog park. So come on out and bring your dog.
And dog parks are really always about people, right? It's really about people interacting as much
as the dogs interacting, yeah. Sure.
We're speaking this hour with Brandon Castillo, Patrick Kennedy, and Vicky Meek. We're talking about Deep Ellum and urban lifestyles. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about Deep Ellum and urban lifestyles with Vicky Meek, who is manager of the South Dallas Cultural Center, Patrick Kennedy, urban dynamics and planning expert and partner at the Space Between Design Studio, and Brandon Castillo, who is director of the Deep Ellum Outdoor Market and owner of Deep Ellum Postal and Grocer. You can be part of this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Jay in Dallas. Hi, Jay.
Hey, what's going on?
Not too much. How are you?
Doing good. Just working and listening to your show.
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I was listening to, like, there's so many points on there. The call earlier about the art galleries, and then the walkability factor you were speaking of, and then the day part of the community that Brandon was talking about as well. Like, there's so much that potential that the area has, but there's just, I think, people have a bad stigma about it from it. It was like the 90s party time, Deep Ellum.
Yeah, so you feel like that's an unfair sort of memory of a time when there were some more problems down there?
Yeah, I think so, and I think just people have a bad taste in their mouth. I mean, it's not that was a bad taste, but they think, oh, dangerous Deep Ellum. It's not dangerous at all. I think any one of your panelists can speak to that.
Well, why don't we let's talk about that a little bit, because people who have been there recently may not be afraid, but there are people who might associate Deep Ellum with a place that is not entirely safe.
Well, I mean, what place is, you know, truthfully, if you live in an urban community, you know, I go down to Deep Ellum frequently, and I'm an old lady now, and I never feel threatened in any way. I love the fact that there are people roaming the streets and, you know, looking in windows and sitting out eating or whatever they're doing. I have been in some really dangerous places, and Deep Ellum isn't one of them.
Dating back to when I was in high school and, you know, really frustrated with growing up in a suburban type place, you know, a perspective I had was, you know, I had to live in an exciting, you know, street life oriented place like New York City or something like that. And I think, and especially during that time, New York City did itself have a bad stigma about it, just, you know. People can point to the street life and how dangerous it is. You might get mugged and stuff like that. I believe Deep Ellum, the feeling on the street reflects what you would find in, you know, San Francisco or New York. And sometimes with, and I'm very much biased against the suburbs, that you know, it has that walk, that street life element that may be unfamiliar with people used to suburban life.
So, in other words, it may not be dangerous. It's just not what people are used to if they sort of go from their garage door to their big box destination. And I don't want to be disrespectful. There are good people living in the suburbs, and
you know,
people
absolutely.
Who care about
absolutely.
Their cities
of
and form communities.
Are.
And I don't want to, you know, you can do it, but I'm not going to do it.
Well, you know, it's also a thing of we are so ready to accept perception, and so much of what we hear about places has to do with perception, not reality. And if you never venture to see, then you never know that it's just a perception. I've heard people say things about South Dallas, how dangerous South Dallas is. I've never had anything dangerous happen to me in South Dallas. And, you know, I've been there for like 17 years, you know. So it's a lot of it is, yes, there are things going on in various places in those communities, but that's not the overall community. You know, you have to really be able to separate fact from fiction.
Well, what does make a community safe? I mean, is it police presence? Is it people sort of knowing the neighborhood well enough to notice when something doesn't look right? And how does that happen in a neighborhood like Deep Ellum?
There's a lot of things going on. There's part of it is police presence when there's a lot of people around. And part of that is also urban form, mm-hmm. where a cop is not in their car, and the cop can be on the street corner and see down in four different ways, right? Like the city street grid with the buildings actually framing the street. And then there's also the people that live there and work there, and then there's enough people there that care about the place. You know, that's sort of the first, they're the first, I guess, first responders are actually the people that live there and know each other, the social connections between each other. And then there's also just the having people around on the street, the Jane Jacobs concept of eyes on the street, and that for the most part, you know, something nefarious is not going to happen where everybody else can see you do it.
We have an email here from Scott who wants to know, will the sidewalks on Elm Street ever be expanded to allow cafe seating and reduce traffic lanes? Is that part
of
the
That's what's happening
expansion?
Right now on Elm Street. I believe it's being taken down to two lanes. It's still going to be one way for the time being, although there's plenty of people that want to ultimately convert it to two-way. And part of the narrowing it down to two lanes, right now it's like four-ish, but sometimes that's parking, that's street parking. But they'll create bulb outs, which is a term for basically extending the sidewalk at intersections to create to foreshorten the crossing distance across the street, and to create more sidewalk and cafe space.
Similar to what's happened in Lower Greenville?
Yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Brent in South Dallas. Hi, Brent.
Oh, I'm in North Dallas, actually.
Oh, okay, North Dallas. Well, thank you for the correction.
I used to live in Deep Ellum. I lived in Deep Ellum from about 86, 87 through early 90s. And when I moved in, I don't think there were more than maybe eight of us living in Deep Ellum. It wasn't zoned for it, and it was a wonderful place, except that food was hard to come by. We had one grocery store, and I saw a lot of development happen. My parents came in and brought in a lot of the art-type people in the Undermain Theater, et cetera, and it was very exciting for many years. And the crime was never a problem that I ever thought of, really, except for the first couple weeks I lived there. I was in a monstrous warehouse, and I'd lay there at night and look out my window at my car, and one day I decided 3-4 in the morning just to go wander the alleys, and, you know, there was no one there. There was nothing going on.
So why did you leave?
People came in that really wanted to invest in the neighborhood and ran us out, basically. Got the building condemned, and so we were gone. But it was a fabulous place, and I recently went by, and it still has a lot of vibrant attitude, and I see a lot going on, and I'm really proud of that. Dallas has a gem there.
Thanks so much for your call. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. What does it take for people to feel that their neighborhood is part of their identity and not simply a place where they go to sleep at night and keep their stuff?
Well, you gotta be engaged in your community. I mean, you know, I feel very attached to two communities, the one I work in, because I'm actually very engaged in that community on a street level, and also the one I live in, because I'm very engaged in that community in terms of the way that I know my neighbors. I do all my shopping in my community. All my amenities are in my community. I don't have to get in my car to go do any of that. So I do think that there's a element of investment, personal investment, that a person has to make in their community. And if you're not connecting to the people in your community, there's not really a community. You know, it's just where you live.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And on top of that, and building on the concept of complete neighborhood and walkability that we were talking about before, in neighborhoods like that, the one competitive advantage that small and local business have is actually the social connections, too, because those have become the third places where people want to hang out and actually interact with the people that are also working there. And it's not just a place of pure economic exchange, but also social exchange. And that starts – when those businesses are local businesses, that starts to create its character that's defined by the residents, too.
I mean, I love going into Gold Rush and having the owner know me and say, hey, and know what I want to eat. You know, I mean, that's my little neighborhood spot, you know, and that's kind of where we have to be when we're talking about creating neighborhoods. It's not just building houses and having people move into them. It's like understanding that there has to be places where they can interact, where they can actually be with each other and not just, you know, go into their driveway and get in their house and that's the end of that.
Do we need to think about our obligations to the neighborhoods we choose to live in, regardless of where they are? You know, we talk so much about what we can give to people who live in neighborhoods, but we don't always talk quite so much about sort of what your job is when you decide to live in a particular area.
Yeah, I think it's responsibility to the community. Mm-hmm. You know, a community is just that, communing. You know, it's not being individual in a place. It's communing with your fellow neighbors. It's understanding the businesses in your community and supporting them. You know, I don't know how to put it any other way. It's about being with the people who you live mm-hmm. around.
I think it's also self-selective in a way that you're moving to a certain neighborhood because that's already happening. And mm-hmm. you do that because you want to do that and you want to be around other people that are also taking up that responsibility. So in a way, you choose your own level of involvement and then choose your neighborhood where you're living. Mm-hmm.
We have an email here from Brian who says, I was in Deep Ellum in the 90s when alternative rock was awesome. Worked there for many years. I get so jealous when I go down to Bishop Arts, neighborhood parking, indented parallel parking, and shaded trees on the sidewalks. I guess just hold out, Brian, and that's coming. Where do you all see Deep Ellum in 10 years? How different might it look? Or how similar might it look?
I think it's going to keep evolving. I think we're not going to be able to put a label on Deep Ellum at all.
I would like to see, especially as a business owner, there more residential, more people actually living there and investing in the community. I'd also love for that empty space across the street from my business to actually be a park. You know, in Baylor's right there, so there's a lot of confluence that. That can happen to
potential synergies, yeah. And Baylor knows they need workforce housing that's close to their campus too. So you've got You've got great amenities already in Deep Ellum. You've got job centers on both sides with downtown and Baylor. And so the time is right, and we've got the demographics that are trying to move back to the city. So I think it's a pretty exciting time for Deep Ellum particularly, and also Dallas on a broader sense too.
I'm wondering though about the land area, and that there's just only so much space in that area to build. You know, it's not mm-hmm. like you have an expanse that's empty that you can just throw up some.
That's
some
exactly why we proposed tearing out a highway.
I know, and I like that idea.
Brandon, have you seen the increased interest in downtown residency? Has that affected sort of foot traffic through the neighborhood of Deep Ellum?
What was interesting when I first started the market is that a lot of, you know, the demographic that was coming through were older. It seemed like they were the Deep Ellum nostalgists. But, you know, as...
Yeah, we've heard a lot of it used to be awesome.
Right. But, you know, we noticed a year later, 2 years later, that our demographic, the average age had dropped. And as I talked to a lot of my friends, people I went to high school with, and especially those who are moving back to Dallas, they are looking for the walkable type of place. And, you know, Deep Ellum, I feel, embodies what people are really looking for nowadays.
How well do people know Deep Ellum who don't live in this part of Texas?
Well, there is a bar in Boston called Deep Ellum. And apparently it was
like opened. A blues bar or what?
I've never actually been. But for a while there, you know, 3 years ago when I did Google searches to help my search engine optimization and stuff like that. But that bar in Boston was the first search item in Google above anything that was actually happening in the neighborhood.
When so. Before I moved here, which was in 2002, and I was telling people, hey, I accepted a job, I'm moving to Dallas, first thing they would say was Deep Ellum.
I can't say that. I had a conversation with Roger Boykin, who's, you know, local jazz and blues musician, and he said that, you know, there's so much mythology around that name that it wasn't even called that when he was playing there. So who knows? I never heard of it, but then again, I didn't know much about Dallas either before I moved here, so...
Okay, if you could each wave a magic wand and change one thing, we just have a few seconds each, what would it be in Deep Ellum?
I would say a grocery store.
Well, I would say a park across the street from my grocery store.
My answer would be obvious. I would tear out 345.
Well, I guess it's really just a summary rather than plumbing new ground in the last few seconds of the show. Patrick Kennedy is who you just heard. He is an urban dynamics and planning expert and partner at the Space Between Design Studio. Vicki Meek is manager of the South Dallas Cultural Center. And Brandon Castillo is director of the Deep Ellum Outdoor Market and owner of Deep Ellum Postal and Grocery. We really appreciate all of you guys being here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for having us.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast, learn more about the show, and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. If you want to communicate comments, questions, or suggestions, email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.